way to really maybe look at the way that we make laws, look at the way we make policies in the long term to be more Indigenous focused, or at least look at it through an Indigenous lens.
Hello and welcome to the High Level Showdown, episode 143, proud members of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. Hello everyone, my name is Michael, joined by Elliot and Sharon on the 143rd High Level Showdown. How are you guys doing?
Late recording this week, guys. I got back late, so apologize for
Elliot, this is a pre-recorded show. They don't know what time.
They don't know what time
this is.
They might be getting out you a bit late tonight.
All our listeners know, we all our episodes could have been recorded at 3 a.m.
exactly,
right?
They don't know.
All right, anyway, I guess you're right.
Yes. Okay, so as usual, we have a jam-packed lineup of topics, so let's get right into it. And Sharon, why don't you introduce us to this very interesting story that just came out today on October the 10th.
Yes, so tomorrow, October 11th, the Supreme Court of Canada is actually going to be delivering a ruling on an issue that could have long-standing impact in the way that legislators make policy all across our country. So the Mikisew Cree First Nation, from here in Northern Alberta, appealed a ruling from the Federal Court of Appeal that said that there's no obligation for cabinet ministers to consult with First Nations peoples before introducing legislation that may have an impact on their constitutionally protected Aboriginal and treaty rights. So as we know, usually a great example is the Trans Mountain Pipeline. The the appeals court said that, you know, the government didn't do enough consultation. That's because during the Harper years, they basically watered down the amount of consultation that governments actually had to do. So that's usually filtered through the National Energy Board later on during certain processes. And this is basically what the Mikisew are challenging right now. They say that the changes which the former Conservative government made in 2012 reduced oversight of their waterways. It hurt the protection of their hunting and fishing and trapping rights, and basically saying that this goes in direct offense of Treaty 8, which was signed in 1899 and enshrined in constitutional rights after the 1982 Constitution Act. People on the other side say, you know, you can't get into this whole Aboriginal right thing with these because that might conflict with the Charter of Rights and how do we decide and things like that. So it's a really interesting case that I'm sure is going to cause a lot of controversy depending on which way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way to describe this is there is a duty to consult Indigenous people when you're making an executive decision at an executive level. For example, a pipeline approval. We just saw that come to the forefront in the latest debacle that is
Trans Mountain
Pipeline. Yeah. And that there the court said not only was there a duty to consult, which is clearly enshrined when the executive makes a decision, but that Justin Trudeau's Liberals and the previous Harper government hadn't done enough consultation on that and therefore need to get done. This would extend to situations where basically there was legislation being put forward changing the rule of law. And I think that that's interesting and complicates things as much. Because I do believe in my heart there is a duty to consult with Indigenous people, and that Indigenous peoples do have a unique aspect of their...
unique perspective.
A unique perspective, but also are an interesting sort of sub-group of individuals in the country. And I think they've been defined as such for a multitude of years in Canadian history. There's a lot of similarities, I think, between Indigenous peoples and the Quebecois nation as well, in the sense that pre-Canada, they had a distinct language. They had borders. They had a distinct society, and that's been used on the Quebec side as well, too.
Yeah.
So my question then would be, if the courts are going to rule in this way, should it not extend the same rights to Quebec and the Québécois as well. That's another interesting part of this too, I think. So it's really complex is what I want to say.
Yeah, well, and just to answer that Quebec portion of it, that's exactly what Quebec wants to hear, right? They've been fighting for a very long time to have that recognition and have more of those powers. And actually, Sharon mentioned Stephen Harper, the Harper government, and they did pass a resolution that recognized Quebec as a distinct society within Parliament. So, but I think you're right. It's the proverbial slippery slope here. You know, how do you proceed with this? It's also interesting that this is coming about during this era of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. A more progressive conversation around the history of Indigenous people. So, I mean, this could have come up 20 years ago. Maybe it did come up 20 years ago, but now it's really, at the forefront. It's part of, I think, a bigger picture.
I think that's a really good point, Michael. I think when we talk about reconciliation, I think it's important to think about what we actually mean. Is reconciliation just, saying it and then no words being backed up by action? When you think about the idea of recognizing the importance of our First Nations people, the people who are first, and considering them and consulting them before any bill is passed that affects their rights in Parliament, I wouldn't even say radical, but I think that would be an amazing way to show that we are really serious about reconciliation. We are very serious about the way that we govern our country going forward takes into account our First Peoples. And so I know there is the tricky thing of, I think the article that I read said it's a very onerous process, right? What does that consultation actually mean? How do we judge, what bills will affect the rights of First Nations people? Mm. But it's kind of interesting in a way for, I think, the government to put their money where their mouth is, to say.
I mean, this isn't the government, though. This is the courts. It's a different story. I get, if you're passing a bill, what triggered this was an egregious a bill put forward by the Harper government limiting protection of waterways
and environmental... Was that not in one of their infamous omnibus budget bills?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So in those sorts of scenarios, I think that you can challenge... There is issues around... That is inappropriate, and that is something to have a real conversation about where... quote unquote, where are you putting your money instead of your mouth, right? And I guess that sounded awkward. there's a difference between that and going to a court case and granting additional rights or talking about the impact that a person's background has on their rights differently than other Canadians in a society, which I think is at the heart of this legal matter. Now, I'm not a legal expert, and I'm not a lawyer, and I do think that there's a duty to consult, and I think Indigenous people's perspectives need to be respected, but that should be done through a legislative body. If they're going to challenge in the courts, there's obviously some conversation around treaty rights superseding charter rights and whether that makes any sense. I think that starts to complicate things, and I don't think it's just as cut and dry as put your money where your mouth is. This isn't a government thing, it's a legislative thing. Or it's not a legislative thing, it's a judicial conversation.
Yeah, I understand that. So saying government and legislative was conflating the two, but I think the sentiment still holds clear is, of course, I think the judicial issues, of course, have longer standing impact than, let's say, governments and things like that. So I do think it would be a really interesting way to really maybe look at the way that we make laws, look at the way we make policies in the long term to be more Indigenous focused, or at least look at it through an Indigenous lens.
Yeah,
I think there's lots of value in that. I mean, you see gender-based policy assessment right now taking... there's lots of interest and buy-in to that, municipally here in Edmonton, but across Canada around. And how does this policy or this policy implication impact marginalized groups or different groups or not traditionally those that have a say? And I think that there's tons of value in that, too. When it comes to the question of the courts, I'm always hesitant to say have one opinion one way or another because I frankly am not a legal expert. And I do know how I feel on these issues, but I know oftentimes the court tends to favor in a way that is much more judicial, I would say.
Yeah, well, and they're supposed to be impartial, right? It's just supposed to be what's just.
Yeah.
Not supposed to be influenced by partisanship. I mean, obviously, that's in an ideal world, but it doesn't happen, right?
Yeah, and so I am pretty sure they'll be looking in their ruling to see if this actually went in... if it was actually in opposition to the treaty acts and the different things like that passed back, you know, when they first came about, not necessarily whether we should be looking at things with a more indigenous lens. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I guess the ruling's going to come out at 9:45 a.m. Eastern time. So,
I mean, if we could have a shocker here. I just, you know, from following the courts and these sorts of decisions all the time, Canada's judicial branch isn't always favorable to Indigenous claims. I think we can all say that's a pretty fair statement. Or isn't always favorable to Indigenous judicial claims. So, but we were all surprised not just, what, 6 weeks ago?
The pipeline decision.
About the pipeline decision, so who knows?
We'll see,
One of the virtues of being part of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB, is that we're surrounded by other great podcasts that cover a number of different issues in and around Edmonton. Taproot Edmonton's Speaking Municipally is an awesome example of one such podcast, hosted by Troy Pavlek and Mac Mail. This weekly discussion is all about key stories in municipal politics. They pay attention to Edmonton City Council, so you don't have to. Join them as they delve into conversations about the context surrounding decisions made at City Hall. Again, that's Speaking Municipally, another proud partner podcast of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB.
Okay, we're just going to provide a brief update on New Brunswick. Who would have thought that the tiny island Atlantic province would be profiled on a high-level showdown twice now in a few weeks? So a few weeks ago, we Sharon and I, you know, okay, we were talking about the results of the New Brunswick election, and Sharon and I, you know, were calling out the Premier Brian Gallant for claiming victory, even though he won less seats than the Conservative Party, and Elliot was saying, oh, well, he was right to do so. Anyway, you can listen to that episode. So
I mean, that's a gross mischaracterization of my point, but whatever.
Oh, I don't think it is. I mean, you were on something that week before pot was legalized. Elliot was on something that a few weeks ago. Anyway, so just to recap, the results of the New Brunswick election had the Conservatives win the most seats, yet it yielded a minority. But the incumbent premier, Brian Gallant, of the Liberal Party, claimed that he was going to form the government, even though his party had won less seats. And, of course, it was contingent on getting support, again, from the ever-important Green Party. And now it seems as if the Liberals are not going to get that support from the Green Party. So, If he does indeed form a government, even though he has less seats, the question of the shelf life of this government is in question, right? It is a minority, and if he doesn't have that support from the balance of power Greens, then New Brunswickers could be headed back to the polls sooner than later.
I just want to comment on this one MLA here from New Brunswick.
Oh, my God.
Underdressed he was for a press conference. Probably okay, the biggest. I mean, come on. Michael and I were talking about this before, and it's like a small, picky thing, but like...
But I agree with you, Elliot.
Come on.
Okay.
Wear a darn suit.
So besides what he was wearing...
We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, what he was wearing... what's your take on the whole Green Party, let's get rid of party lines, let's all come together and sign this declaration of intent that is in support of people? It's not about who gets the majority and who's in power, it's about all of us collaborating and working together for the good of the people of New Brunswick. What do you think about that?
I think it's a utopia,
it's idealistic.
Yes, I know, and yes, we need idealism to drive us, certainly, but there's a time when you put idealism to the side for a little bit and embrace, reality. I don't know. It doesn't seem like I don't know the leader of the Green Party in New Brunswick, but a guy who's in tune with the political realities, I mean, it kind of reminds me, you know, we just spoke of indigenous people, and in Northwest Territories, they don't have, I believe they don't have parties. Yeah. It's a consensus government, you know. So this year, the Liberal leaders, the Green Party leader, saying, "Oh, the hell with parties. Let's just work together as a happy family."
He's
saying,
okay, first of all, mm-hmm. that he's not going to support the Liberals unless he hears the throne speech. He wants to hear how this Liberal government intends to rule, and then he'll make his decision. But also, further complicating things is that he's saying him and his two other MLAs don't have to all vote the same thing. So he could like the speech and vote for it. The other one couldn't, which would probably get us in the exact same position as before, as that no one has the majority. So it's a very bizarre kind of situation. Elliot, what do you think? Do you think it's a step forward of the way that our democracies should be run? Do you think it's great?
No, absolutely not. This is ludicrous. This is absolutely ridiculous. Like, he's clearly not going to side with the Conservative Party. He's not interested in siding with the Conservative Party. They're so far ideologically right from the Green Party that he clearly has no interest in it at all. He should be leveraging his power as a third party.
He
should be, because if he wants to get things done and wants to actually do things on behalf of people, the people of New Brunswick, and make it, you know, you could sign a very clear and direct deal. Like the Greens have in BC, one of the expectations the Green had in order to side with the NDP was that they were going to have a referendum on proportional representation before the next election. That was like a deal breaker for the Greens. They leveraged their power as a third party to get a meaningful policy piece done in the legislature.
Yeah.
This I do not see as commitment to anything. You go in there and you sign a deal. These are my demands. The Liberal guy goes, "I can't do this, I can't do this." You work it out. He says, "Go out, you know, you have the whole negotiation." This sort of like idealized utopian thing that Michael was talking about, I don't know, he lost me halfway through. It sounds like socialism to me.
It's
like literally.
Actually, what he believes in is that common ground that reflects the foundational principles of New Brunswick, Aboriginal and treaty rights, bilingualism, dual education systems, a commitment to fighting poverty,
New Brunswick is already
fiscal and ecological debts, and
the only bilingual
autonomy
province
of the legislature.
But you need a clear policy vision and idea, and then you bring that forward.
This is his policy, and he wants all the MLAs.
This isn't a policy.
He wants
this
all
is a
the
piece
MLAs
of paper
to sign it.
This is, it's like, you could sign this and it would mean nothing.
Yeah,
it's like the North Korean deal with Donald Trump.
I'm with Elliot on this one. I think
it means nothing.
I'm with Elliot. I think
it's a show.
It's a vague set of proposals of the best society. I mean, it's like in a social studies class, and you give the students like, what do you want to see your government do?
If I'm a Green Party member in this country, my face is melting right now. Because I have just
seen...
They look
like a joke.
They look... I've just seen a very powerful, competent Andrew Weaver in BC make meaningful policy implications in the province of BC. And meaningful because he held the balance of power. And they gave them the Green Party credibility. It meant people could buy into a green ideology. They could see that voting for Greens could actually make a difference.
Yeah.
And it probably led to the 4 seats that these guys got in New Brunswick, because it lended some credibility to their work. And these guys just flushed it down a table. The toilet.
He's so mad. So, I mean, I agree with you guys. It's pretty ridiculous. But we'll see. Gallant, the Liberal leader, has said he will definitely sign the thing if they will support.
Of course he would. He just got handed power on a go. You're going to sign something. I don't recognize and affirm Aboriginal and treaty rights and Indigenous people. You're not going to sign that.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
I don't believe in a right to a healthy and safe environment in New Brunswick. That is counter to my policy. Like. Oh my God!
Totally, no,
are you
totally,
be okay,
yeah,
Elliot?
No.
I am going to be watching this with bated breath, because who knows what the Green Party members will come up with next. And hopefully next time at the next press conference, the one guy is wearing
I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Tantipoli right
but
here.
But let's go into that guy for a second. Elliot and I
were... I am not done.
We were having a discussion before the show started. And, you know, we talk about decorum.
Okay,
and
we can get to that. But let me just finish what's going to happen. Because I know what's going to happen here. This is going to fall apart. one of these green MPs or MLAs at one point is not going to like it. They're not going to sign it. The Liberals, the government's going to fall apart. And then they're going to go back to the polls. And every single person from New Brunswick who voted for the Greens are like, wow, that was a wasted vote. Those guys had an opportunity to do something, and they clearly did not live up to the power I instilled in them by giving them my vote. Instead, they flushed their power down the toilet. Mm-hmm. I'm either voting BC or PC or Liberal, and then you'll have a majority in the next one around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, okay. You want to go back to
the... Well, no, just addressed? To go back to that, I mean, yes, it might be insignificant, but let's bring this guy up. So this was a press conference that was held today. He was a Green Party MLA, was he not?
Yes.
Yes. And he, you know, certainly...
I guess Kevin Arsenault.
He certainly, you know, he showed up like a lumberjack, you know, wearing a flannel shirt and jeans. You know, he's an elected official. And, you know, we do expect our male elected politicians to be wearing suits. You know, maybe not necessarily a tie, but at least, dress clothing.
Put on a damn jacket.
Yeah. This guy comes out looking like an average Joe on the street. God. And I think there is an importance to respecting the position that you've been, you know, elected to, and showing respect for... I mean, if obviously it wouldn't happen in the legislature itself. Oh, I don't know. I don't think that'd be allowed. But it is an interesting, you know, commentary on how some people view...
I will post a picture of this outfit that Michael and Elliot are so pissed about.
You mean Michael more than me. I was more making a joke.
No, I wasn't. I'm not outraged. I'm not outraged.
It is pretty inappropriate.
But it's, it just goes to show a lot about, I guess, the respect towards the role.
Especially given that the piece of paper that man is signing in this photo where he is improperly dressed is the last major public thing he's going to be a part of, because he's going to get voted out in the next election.
Yeah. And it's true. I think there is something to be said about a time and place to wear casual clothing. You know, when the politicians descend on the Calgary Stampede, of course they're wearing jeans and a cowboy hat. But that's the environment that they're in. But when they're signing, the Prime Minister is not wearing jeans when they table a budget. There's I think a reason for that. So an interesting little observation there. Okay, so let's continue, and we're going to go now to South America and to just take a look at some of the latest developments in Venezuela. We have talked about Venezuela on this show before, and it's a continuation of a deteriorating economic climate and civil society there. The socialist president, Nicolas Maduro, of course, took over after the death of Hugo Chavez, was a disciple of Hugo Chavez and helped in his Bolivarian revolution, socialist revolution. And so he's now been in power for 5 years. And as of late, you know, last few years, and it's been particularly bad last few months, last year or so, the economy of Venezuela is in horrible condition. And the state of democracy in Venezuela is under assault. We're seeing the opposition members jailed. We're seeing a crackdown on the opposition. We're seeing elections that are being meddled with. We're seeing an affirmation of power from Nicolas Maduro to really solidify himself as a president for life, as a defender of the Venezuelan constitution, of the socialist revolution. So it's a very sad story in Venezuela. There's many Venezuelans that have been, you know, fleeing the country just because they can't get basic necessities like food and water. And, you know, Venezuela is a relatively resource-rich country, but it's being, squandered by the government. Now, a new development that has come up, which caught my attention, I've, you know, found quite disturbing, was the death of Fernando Albán. Fernando Albán was an opposition member. He was actually a city councilor of Caracas, which is the capital of Venezuela. And he was arrested for conspiracy to kill Nicolas Maduro. So there's obviously a paranoia coming out from the Maduro administration, the presidency. So Fernando Albán and several others were arrested. And now it has been announced that Fernando Albán has died. Now, the government is claiming that he committed suicide. He jumped out of a window 10 stories out of a building. And the opponents of the government and friends and supporters of Albán say, well, that's not right. Fernando Albán would never do such a thing. We believe that he was actually killed by the regime. So it's a specific example, but it's part of a greater malaise in Venezuela right now that doesn't seem to be getting better at all. And it's quite disturbing.
It's very sad. I mean, What do you think is the role of, you know, the international players and allies, or not that Venezuela has allies, but the UN or anyone else to be able to step in and call for, you know, justice for the Venezuelan people?
Well, I mean, I think you've seen the typical reaction by the international community that you see in these situations. Some very severe and harsh sanctions against the government. Those are obviously making their way down to the people of Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So you can have a debate about whether there is value in that or not. I mean, there was some talk, particularly in light of recent events, this murder-suicide debacle, that a similar response to Venezuela is necessary from the international community to that of Russia, a Magnitsky mm-hmm. Act type effect in which senior people in the government are specifically targeted by sanctions, not necessarily the entire country. Mm-hmm. That has seemed to be a very powerful move and very good at causing disruption at upper levels of governments, because when the rich people supporting the dictator begin to be upset, rumblings of coups start to happen. And I think that there is some value in that as well. But those sorts of efforts need to be led by a courageous and smart and well-articulated national or international strategy that is usually sung in chorus but directed by the United States. And we have not seen much interest by the United States to engage fruitfully in the types of negotiations that would be needed to create a Magnitsky Act type pressures on Maduro and the people surrounding him. So I think that is my initial reaction to this, and some of the initial fallout of this situation. I mean, what frustrates me is I think that this, Michael, might be one of the topics, and Maduro might be one of the longest standing issues that we've touched on this show. I mean, I think we've been talking about Maduro nearly since the beginning of High Level Showdown. Here we are 143 episodes later, and nothing has been done. The situation has gotten worse. Yeah. The public upset has been worse. So where are we at? Well, that's a pretty good indication as to where we're at.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that you mentioned the United States, and I think obviously we've seen the shift in foreign policy under this president, so somebody else has to take up that job. You know, we can't rely on the United States to lead the charge in condemning.
I've heard we're from a peacekeeping country.
Yeah, well, you know, so it's, I guess the problem is that nobody wants to take that charge. You know, we're just like, well, somebody has to do something, but who's going to do it? Why, you know, and this is not exclusive to Nicolas Maduro, you know, many dictators have flourished in the past because there's always widespread condemnation, but really what is there to do when nobody specifically steps up to do anything about it? You know? Or the UN itself, I mean, as a global governing, well, it's not a governing body, but as a global political entity, you know, what can the UN do without intervening and causing a sort of a civil war, a hot war?
I mean, I kind of disagree. I think we're in new territory with people like Maduro, Putin. I think that previously we've had situations where terrible dictators that mistreated their citizens got away with it. One, because I don't think the media covered it as much, and there wasn't as much access to internet and news and information. But I think it was also because oftentimes those dictators were propped up by larger governments in proxy wars around political ideologies. You know, you think back to the Cold War and how many evil people were propped up by either the USSR or America in order to ensure. So I think that we're in a place now where countries are hesitant to get involved in proxy wars. They're hesitant to depose because you end up in a nation building role, which is very expensive. Never works and is always problematic.
Well, you know,
and often leads to more terror and more upset.
I think
look
one
at
of
Saddam
the
Hussein is a great example.
Great
of that.
Yes, absolutely. I think another great one, and one that really does not get coverage at all in the media, is Libya, which you know, the toppling of Gaddafi after the civil war in Libya, you know, which was also sponsored by NATO, who led airstrikes, and since Gaddafi's death. It's just been total lawlessness in Libya. There's been a number of transitional governments and transitional leaders, but there is still not a sense of an emerging democracy at all. It's like tribal warfare in Libya. And so, you know, and maybe that's a worry. You know, Gaddafi certainly was a dictator, but he kept Libya together like Hussein did in Iraq, you know, and we saw the power vacuum that emerged after his you know, fall. Is there a worry of that too, you know, of if the leader falls and then, but there's no clear future after that?
Sharon, should we be going around and just forcing people to engage in democracy?
Yeah.
See, no. I mean, it's hard, right? Because obviously, I was born in a country where a dictator ruled for a very long time, and there's many times when you're like, oh, wouldn't it be just so much easier if someone from the West came in and, you know, did something? But again, like, we all know about colonialism as well. So I think it's a very slippery slope, right, when you think about whose responsibility is to, you know, spread goodwill and democracy, and whether the model that we decide to govern ourselves is necessarily wanted all over the world. We see, I mean, there's many examples, right? Look at Iraq, Afghanistan after, you know, intervention. It's not as easy to just go in there and say, hey, we're going to be a democracy now. So I don't have the answers. I don't think anyone does. If we did, we wouldn't see those situations. But ultimately, the saddest thing is the people, right, who are suffering at the hands of these governments. And,
I mean, there's lots of messes in the Middle East, and there's been, and that's really well documented. Mm-hmm. I think the two places in this world that have been underreported, I would, in terms of human tragedy and suffering at the hands of evil people, Venezuela has to be right up there with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And North Korea does get lots of coverage, but I don't think enough of, like, on the ground, just because no one can get in there. No one can really document it. Here, it is being documented. There are reporters on the ground, although it's very dangerous right now, particularly to be in that situation. And I know that there are some great reporters at the New York Times, for example, who have been trying to document what's going on in Venezuela as it goes on, and that's got tons of challenges. But it is sort of one of those, it feels like, I mean, a Rwanda parallel is not fair. And,
well,
there's
not a genocide.
But there is, Michael, I think,
it's a cultural, political genocide.
When I'm 58 as opposed to 28, and I look back on Venezuela and what happened at this point, I think I'll be very disappointed in the world that I was living in, and even myself for not having done more because of the awful state of things in Venezuela right now. I mean, Maduro's so delusional. I read a story this week about this Petro, which is his new like cryptocurrency that they've tried to create in order to circumvent sanctions against Venezuela, and he's calling on, and it may become mandatory for all Venezuelans to buy into this cryptocurrency, which is basically just a way for him to raise money to fuel his cartel.
Well, because he's bankrupt. I mean, the government.
Yeah, you know, of corruption. And you know, the U.S. government has said quite simply, it's a tool of corruption, that no one should be investing in it. If you invest in this cryptocurrency, you are essentially funding a dictator. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, another, like, just brazen attempt at trying to circumvent international law and not dealing with the actual issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when you have people like Maduro who call on, then use the names of Chavez to, you know, incite some sort of fake view of the world.
Yes, yeah. It's that
glory, right? You know, the American imperialist, you know, instead of taking responsibility for his own actions. I mean, he's so delusional, it's beyond reproach, really.
Yeah.
Which I think is also incredibly... I mean, even like the drone attack that they claimed that this counselor had orchestrated was like, seemed like the stupidest thing. And like, yeah. It's like barely, it seems really widely recognized. Maybe news media is a bit hesitant to go this far, that it was obviously like a false flag attempt by the Maduro government
to sanction
a further crackdown in power. Well, and how, how delusional you have to be to engage in that type of. To that type of action.
You know, and we've seen authoritative parties in the past, you know, who stage events to justify their actions.
Yeah.
You know, the Nazis, of course, burned the Reichstag, right? Or they actually attacked a Polish... They attacked a radio tower in the lead-up to the invasion of Poland as an excuse to, you know, justify the start of the Second World War. In another example, you know, perhaps the Maduro's goons did set up this supposed assassination attempt.
Yeah.
And, you know, arrested this dissident.
And many others. And many others. This has been going on for a while. So
yeah.
It's incredibly frustrating. I think this, not unlike the conversation in Myanmar that we highlighted a long time ago on our live show, is something that we need to keep an eye on, because there are obviously people's lives at stake
here. Yeah.
Totally.
This is getting serious.
I'll just add one more thing. It's also sad for the country itself, because of the migration of people who are leaving, who may never return. You know, we talk about the Syrian refugees, and they've left Syria now, unlikely to go back. And, you know, these Venezuelan refugees are now going into Colombia and such are, you know, so Venezuela is losing these people. They are losing, just as Syria, just any country that loses refugees is losing that pool of talent and intelligence. And it's impoverishes that country, who needs these people if they're going to get back to a sense of normalcy. So just tragic. We'll keep an eye on that, because I don't think Maduro is going anywhere anytime soon.
Edmonton is home to Canada's first and only non-fiction festival. Yeah, that's LitFest. It runs October 11th to 21st and features dozens of events with writers from across the country and beyond, all sharing true stories and big ideas about culture, food, science, politics, and more. Some of the writers are Dr. Brian Goldman of CBC Radio's White Coat, Black Art, and Globe and Mail columnist Elizabeth Renzetti. That's just a sample. There are many more listed at litfestalberta.org. Remember, festival passes are only $129, and 4-packs and single tickets are available. By the way, you can get $5 off by using the promo code APNROCKS. That's $5 off by using the promo code APNROCKS. Get your tickets today at litfestalberta.org.
All right, and now is that part of the show where we head down south and talk about our pals in America. It's time for
Trump Watch.
So we're starting in
New York. I see how it is, guys. This is a two-person show. I'm not allowed to do the Trump Watch anymore.
Well, I mean,
this is rude.
Sorry, Elliot. I mean, we were all waiting to see who would do it. You didn't step up. I know you're a little nervous about the timing.
I am not nervous.
Oh, okay.
Not nervous.
Obviously, Elliot is the least musical person here, so he can't count in his head very well. So he can't keep beats or rhythm.
Okay, so
that's all right. That's okay.
We're going to be doing switching Trump Watch up a little bit, leading up to a big night or day for everyone is midterms. So midterms are happening in November, just a few weeks away. What's the date, Elliot? November 6th?
November 6th, midterm Tuesday.
Nice, midterm Tuesday. Yes, I call it super fragilistic It's midterm Tuesday. And so...
Original.
Thank you. So leading up to the midterms, we're actually going to be, instead of, you know, talking about Trump's bullshit, we're going to be talking about various races that could get us closer to getting rid of Trump. And so there is probably, I don't know, what's the chances, like 1 in 5 chance that the Senate flips in any way?
As of today.
As of today. But really, the House of Representatives is the one that people are saying this is going to be a key factor in getting more Democrats in the House and changing the course of American politics. So each week, we're going to be talking about some of these hotly contested races, talking about some of these candidates and what makes them so interesting. So, Elliot, why don't you kick us off with week one of our midterm madness?
Well, of course, we have to go somewhere where, you know, they were looking for a close battle, something unique and kind of different. Mm-hmm. And Sharon did some excellent digging and research. And she suggested, and I think we're all into this, going to the North Carolina District 9.
North Carolina!
So North Carolina, of course, has been dogged with lots of scandal.
I hear they really like trans people.
Overzealous, lame duck Senate House, who basically limited the powers of the incoming Democratic governor because they were so mad that in 2016 it was the only election that didn't really go for Republicans. After, I think, the NBA and a number of tech startups decided to move major events in out of North Carolina in response to getting rid of a bathroom bill.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's kind of a backward place, but...
sorry to any people from North Carolina.
Yeah, I'm sorry if you can send the hate mail
it's
to you.
Sort of a backward
place. At High Level Show on Twitter.
Jesus.
Because I don't really care if you send it to me.
So who are these two guys, Elliot? I mean, assuming that they're males.
Yeah, they are good. They're, you know, it is North Carolina, so they are two good... God-loving men. The Democratic Dan McCurdy, a businessman.
I think it's McCready.
McCready, that's right.
What did I say? McCready? Yeah.
You said McCurdy.
McCurdy. Bruce
just
McCurdy.
Just like those milk, just like those milk curds from last week.
Dan McCready is a Democrat. He's a former businessman. He actually founded a solar energy company. So that's interesting.
You're forgetting the most important
part. He's a U.S. Marine who served in Iraq and
God
loves
bless
God.
America.
He loves God.
Because I'm proud to be an American.
Yes.
I mean, he went to Harvard, and that's interesting, too.
No, him being a Marine is the most important thing for people in North Carolina, let's be honest.
And
but
his closeness
anyway,
to God.
Yes. But go on. Who's the Republican?
The Republican is a little-known gentleman named Pastor Mark Harris.
Amen!
He is, he's a PhD in Christian leadership from Southeast Baptist Theological Seminary.
Yes, Lord!
He promises to be people-focused and a representative who will be guided by his Christian faith and family.
Hallelujah!
While in Congress. I think what's more interesting about this than the people, because they're so boring old white men, is
McCready's
that
pretty
this
young.
Is a very, he's, this is a very, he's on his like sixth career. the polls on this race are too close to call.
Yeah.
So the lovely people at, 538 have basically a 49.4 chance to 50.6 chance for the Mark Harris, the Republican. But if you start to look at some of their other breakdowns in terms of, like the deluxe one brings in a bunch of different outside sources, like fundraising dollars, those sorts of things, you start to see things favor the Democrat more. And the light, which is basically just polls, shows a slight edge for the Democrat. This is a really close race, and I think is a great example of this is a seat that traditionally is a plus 13 red, which would mean that it's 13% more Republican than the nation on average.
Crazy.
And if this is the kind of seat that's in play for the Democrats, you're going to see a what could be a very potentially big flip yeah. in the House.
So it's interesting reading into this one because McCready is, you know, not really a seasoned politician anyway. Neither is Mark Harris. You know, he was actually an upset win for the Republican nominee. He beat an incumbent, someone with the name Pentagoner or something like that. Some guy. That he beat, who he actually got beaten by 2 years ago. And so he was a surprise win. But what's also interesting is that...
So he primaried him and beat the incumbent.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Dan McCready actually is interesting. And I think what about this race is that both of them, because they're in North Carolina, because it always goes red, is that Dan McCready is a little bit more right than you necessarily see for a Democrat. He said that he's not sure if he would support Nancy Pelosi going in as a Democrat. Again, certain things that Elliot said, very like Christian rhetoric, talking about, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm a Marine. A lot of things you'd see from Republican candidates. And that's in an effort to really show people that, hey, Democrats, we can win this. We are, you know, close to your values. And so it's going to be interesting to see Mark Harris trying to set himself apart from McCready, because usually for a lot of Republicans running in these types of races, they're able to say, oh, well, look at these like heathens or whatever it is. So it's going to be interesting, this dance that happens here in North Carolina.
So it's like, like taking the, you know, if you're like your opponent,
yeah.
but just slightly
yeah,
different.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so when it gets down to the issues, it's very tough. For them to separate themselves in debates and things like that. I mean, both of them, I think a debate happened either yesterday or today, and were asked, would you support Trump being, you know, impeached? A lot of Democrats, of course, in many other races would be like, heck yeah, get that guy out of there. McCready actually said, you know what, I don't like to deal in hypotheticals. I'd like to know all the information. That's clearly trying to, pander to those
voters. I mean,
voters.
This is obviously a strategy of his, but do you think, you know, he says all these things and pretends to be, have the stripe of Republicanism in him, and then if he should be elected, and then, you know, just falls with the Democrats,
and
caucuses with them, and goes against Trump, and sort of fools the electorate, and says, you voted for me.
I mean,
is this genuine, or is this a sort of a
wolf in sheep's clothing?
Yeah, is this sort of a ruse to get elected in a you know, hostile environment?
I mean, I'm not convinced as many people. I know I've said this before, and a lot of people are saying this, that you actually have to run to the center right now. If you're a Democrat, you should be standing for what you believe in, and I mean, some of his rhetoric is. I think there is sort of a sheen to it, Michael, for sure. But on issues that matter, and that matter to whether you're a Democrat or not, he comes down on the side of Democrats. Abortion rights, immigration, climate change. Those are not things that you'd expect to be hearing out of someone that has a chance to win a congressional seat in North Carolina. And those are all things in which he's on the Democratic side of the party.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, in some ways, sure, he is moderating his tone. Obviously, he's aligned himself with, you know, a more centrist viewpoint, and has maybe made some statements about indecision and with regards to his statements. But at the end of the day, when you go out and check off those boxes, it used to be a Democrat who was running to the center was maybe had a much more conservative view on something like abortion rights or taxes or immigration. You know, maybe it wouldn't be all of those things. It would be half or something like that, you know, and they would hold those positions. And it led to the Democrats being slaughtered everywhere. So it's, in my view, I think that there's a lot to think about here. Moderation is moderation. But I think on the major issues, on important votes and the votes that will be important coming up in the coming 2 years, as we move into the next presidential election, McCready's kind of where you want to be.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I feel like this is the hardest choice that a Republican has ever had to make between someone who served in the military and a pastor. What are they going to do?
Yeah.
You know, it's like an existential crisis. So this is going
to
be...
I mean, McCready has lined up pretty close to God on this one, too.
He is. I mean, he did find the Lord while serving in the military, actually. Before we... That wasn't a joke.
I mean, that's like the kind of line that, like, I think like Republican like lawmakers are like, oh my god, if there's a guy that found God well in the military, yeah. I can't beat him.
Yeah. Totally. Some of the more, I don't know if it's fun, but it's, you know, classic Republican, and some of the things that they're going to be using against him is Mr. Harris, because he's been a longtime pastor, of course, has done many sermons, is very open about his beliefs. So, of course, he's opposed to gay marriage. He's questioned whether careers were the healthiest pursuit for women. He's called for women to submit to their husbands and many other kind of, you know, flagrant things that he said in sermons. So those are some of the things that are being used against him in this election. So it's going to be a rough and tumble ride, and can't wait to see what happens in North Carolina 9th.
So if there is an election that you hear about that you think is interesting, that you want us to talk about, you know, make it kind of close. Because if it's like, you know, is it Victoria? Ocasio-Cortez, what's her name? That's her name, right?
I was getting so.
Like, I don't want to talk about like her, right? She's gonna wipe the floor, and she should, and that's great. Let's find some interesting races like this. Yeah. Talk about some weirdo American politics stuff.
That's right.
Great. What's your 780 this week, Elliot?
My 780 this week. Great question, Sharon. And I'm so glad you've asked me this.
Oh, perfect!
Because I did a lot this weekend. It was, of course, Thanksgiving.
Oh, yes.
And I have to say that my 780 goes out to my mother, who made an outstanding Thanksgiving feast to celebrate all the things that we have to give thanks for. She even made these cute little cards that she put on everyone's plate, and it was all the different letters of Thanksgiving, and then we had to say something that we were thankful for that started with that letter. And that was really
yours?
Fun.
That's
cool. Mine was S, and so I was thankful for Sunday dinners with my family.
Very
That's
nice.
That's
cute. Very good.
Michael, what's your 780?
Right, I want to talk about A Star Is Born. That's a latest film as the Oscar season.
Good?
Yes, it is.
The
yes,
trailer looked horrendous.
Horrendous?
Yeah,
why would
like,
you say
in
that?
In what world would I ever see this?
Why would you say that?
Oh my god, you know, they really tried to make Bradley Cooper look so unattractive, like an alcoholic, but like what alcoholic has like six-pack abs and, you know, is just so perfect.
And
then
why can't Glenn
they have
Close
this,
win
like,
an Oscar, Michael? Why can't Glenn Close win an Oscar?
It just seems so
Glenn
cliche.
Close.
No, never mind.
Okay, anyway.
She's not in this
It
movie.
Seemed really cliche on first look. Of course, I'm judging a book by the cover.
Well, I, you
so,
know,
but
I don't
I've heard
think
good
I,
things about
I,
it.
I certainly
and
enjoyed
it. And did you
it.
Enjoy it?
Yes, I did, very much, actually.
Gaga
and,
is in it, Elliot.
I know, yes. But Glenn Close is in another movie
okay.
She's not going to win for, because Gaga's going to win for this.
Yes, she might. That's what I wanted to talk about. the film is, you know, perhaps some will feel that it is cliche. And certainly the story can be seen as predictable. It's, you know, basically about a rock star who meets a young aspiring singer and, you know, helps launch her career. And, you know, of course, as her star rises, his star fades. But it is a very tender-hearted film that I should mention the acting, which I think was very, very good. The you'll probably hear this from many critics upon this particular film, is that the chemistry between Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper is very natural and certainly very emotional and heartwarming. And the story is you know, tugs at your heartstrings, certainly, but it has those moments of inspiration. And it's also a very strong first effort from Bradley Cooper as a director. He is the director of this film, so as making his directorial debut, he was told not to choose A Star Is Born as material. Of course, this is the third remake of this. It first started in 1937, then 1954 with Judy Garland, and 1976 with Barbara Streisand and Chris Christopherson.
The remake almost had Beyoncé in it.
Yes, originally she was in talks. In fact, Clint Eastwood
was
the original choice to direct. Anyway, Bradley Cooper has created a very
good
film. Yes, the performances are very strong. It's a very smart and engaging emotional screenplay. And yes, Lady Gaga certainly shows that
she can act.
Yes, very much so. So I would say that, you know, she'll likely win an award or two. I mean, the Academy Awards may be a stretch, but I could certainly see at least a Golden Globe nomination or a potential win. And the film itself to probably be nominated for Best Picture and maybe a few other awards like Best Original Screenplay. So an enthusiastic recommendation for A Star Is Born.
Feel bad for Glenn Close.
Oh my God. Okay, so,
Elliot, you're just such a fan of Glenn Close.
Name without, us a movie.
Without looking on Wikipedia.
Yeah, okay.
Name me some Glenn Close movies.
Well, of course, there's the classic 101 Dalmatians.
Very good. Okay.
Yeah, that's what the else? Only one I remember. Oh, she should have won the Oscar for that.
You don't remember the one where she boiled the rabbit in the pot?
I didn't see that one.
An affair with Michael Douglas?
I didn't see that one.
Fatal Attraction.
Oh, yes, of course. How could I forget? Fatal Attraction.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, anyway.
Okay, I'm impressed. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, my 780 this week actually goes out to City Council, Edmonton City Council, and it's not a happy 780.
So oh, no, not again.
I know. So it was more about the comments that were made during a debate about free transit in our city. And so Aaron Paquette, the counselor for Ward... Northeast Edmonton, and he had a motion to study the economic impact of transit and review the fare structure, because although we know that there is subsidies for transit, it still is something that is pretty unaffordable for a lot of people, and there's many people who can't afford to pay, who rack up, you know, fines and different things like that, whatever it may be. And so the city council actually today shut that debate down. There's not going to be any motion to even consider a review of the fare structure. I think Tony Caterina, your counselor,
yeah,
Michael,
Ward 7.
Said that transit doesn't even come close to being an essential service. Police are an essential service. Fire is an essential service, but not transit. Which it's just not true. Obviously, many of us who are
That's a perspective of a car owner, of course.
Exactly, right? And someone who has the privilege of owning a car, who's able to maintain car payments, whatever it may be. But we know that there's a lot of people in our city, more than a lot of people would think, who rely very heavily, if not exclusively, on transit. So I think whether we can afford it or whatever it may be, there's lots of things that we pay money for in the city that city council funds that don't necessarily have such great impact. But I think that the fact that they wouldn't even consider a review of this is really disappointing to me. And another shot at vulnerable people.
Yeah, I think this is a topic we should, consider probably discussing on another episode, outside of the 780.
Oh, sorry, let me correct myself. It ran out of time, so it's been bumped to the October 23rd council meeting. So they actually didn't make a decision, but Don Iveson ended the conversation saying he has no appetite to even look at free transit. Really wants to end poverty in Edmonton, hey guys?
No comment.
Food for thought.
Yeah, but I agree with you. Let's talk about it in the future, perhaps.
Yeah, certainly. In a very, you can see the different perspectives on this, but definitely a very, very contentious issue. Okay, so this has been episode 143 of the High Level Showdown. My name is Michael. You can reach me on Twitter at MaestroMichael2 and Sharon.
You can reach me at SharonMVU.
North Carolina, get at me! At Tandy Yang!
Jesus. You can find our show at High Level Show. We again apologize for Elliot's behavior. Thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next week.